Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Nes Fromm, the co-founder of a company called Alpha. Alpha is in the business of helping companies make sense of their user interactions with their product so that they can use it to make their products better. How are you today, Nes?
I'm doing well. Excited to be part of this conversation. How are you?
Great. Thank you. I know you have your own podcast, so this is like being on the other side of the table.
Yeah. It's pretty meta.
Yeah. So Nes, I'm interested to find out, a little bit about your background. What is Alpha and what problem does it specifically solve?
Sure. Yeah. So my background's in startups. I had a company before this where kind of small iterative startup, you know, we ate up the lean mantra and that's what we did. We talked to customers every day and it was still really, really difficult to iterate on customer feedback. As we were winding down that company, I met up with a guy named Thor, who had started companies as well, but had seen what applying lean in a very large organization looked like and the difficulties there. And we talked about, well, we already knew how difficult lean was just in a startup where that's the only thing you do is iterate on product. And we talked about how difficult that was in a big company. And we thought, why don't we bring some of the startup methodologies to a big company, but in a platform, in a way that actually makes sense for large organizations that are in heavily regulated environments to generate user insights and inform decisions every day or two, not every 3 to 6 months. And so that's what we've focused on doing. And Alpha is really the manifestation of that platform, of that vision of on-demand user insights. And, 4 years later, we have about a third of the Fortune 100 using the platform.
Just so I understand better, how exactly does the process work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, from a bird's eye view, it's as simple as you put in a plain English question to our platform. It could be a question about users, about a competitor, about product. And 2 days later, you get insights, user interviews, charts, split test results, stuff like that. What happens in between is basically our platform streamlines, accelerates, and automates a workflow of sourcing your target audience, creating an interactive prototype, scripting a test, and then analyzing the results. We use machine learning and freelancer networks, as well as technology to really streamline those steps that in a large organization can take 3 to 6 months.
The first part of it, asking a question, is like going to Quora and saying, you know, I'm looking for this. So let's say a company goes and I'm going to think about a retail or e-commerce application, for example. But what would be like a typical question that somebody in that line of business would ask?
Sure. So if you're Amazon, you're really, really smart about Amazon customers who have Prime, right? Because you have a ton of data from them and you're just very, very close to that community. But what you don't have is people who go to Walmart. So you might want to ask a few hundred people, when was the last time they bought something on Walmart? Why did they use Walmart instead of Amazon? And you might say, what if Amazon had this new feature? You know, we're not going to spend $5 million to build it, but we might want to prototype this new feature that you can click one button and it compares the price that you're already shopping on Amazon to the price on Walmart to show you it's a better deal or that you'll get the product a day faster, right? Would that convince Walmart shoppers to shop on Amazon instead?
These are somewhat different use cases, at least from what I'm thinking about. It could be just a business question, you know, or marketing question. But when it comes to a new feature, you probably want to show something to people before they get. So that means that the input to the system would be more like a mock-up or like even an MVP or?
Yeah, it would be a sketch. So basically our job as a company is to teach companies how to ask questions. We have templates for questions throughout the product lifecycle. The first couple examples I gave would be more like user discovery. What pain points do people have? Competitive overview. How are they solving those problems? And what you're talking about, really our bread and butter, is that prototype-driven experimentation, which is I have a napkin sketch. I have a whiteboard and there's 10 people on our product team in a room. We're all arguing over the best way to approach solving a problem. We have 10 different ideas. We need to get some insights really quickly about where we should prioritize our roadmap. And how features should look, what the value proposition should be. And that's where our prototype-driven experimentation can get you insights really quickly.
Okay. And this is
People reacting to prototypes.
And this is done in 2 days, right?
Yeah. less than 2 days. So less up to 2 days.
You have to go find the people first. Make sure that they are in the right group and then run the process and the question and get the feedback and then actually put that in a digestible format, the person who asked the question, right?
Exactly. That's what we spent the last 4 years building is the integrations to be able to source those target audiences through different ad tech and panel providers and those sort of marketplaces to ensure quality. All of that is a lot of technology, a lot of algorithms to ensure that people are giving authentic feedback, people are who they say they are, that we have a global network of designers that creates these interactive prototypes, same day turnaround. They can take napkin sketches and turn those into envisioned prototypes. And then we have a really robust data visualization tool that doesn't, that can really cut through the noise and find meaningful insights for users. I just sent you a link as well to Axios. They've published different reports we've done. So like Facebook at their F8 conference in May announced they'd have a new dating service. We actually took copy from their announcement, from their website about the dating service. We put it into our platform. It got prototyped into, you know, what that experience might look like and started generating feedback from people who use free dating apps and people who use paid dating apps. And we kind of gauged their interest in a Facebook offering. And so Axios kind of wrote about those reports. They've done that as well. We tested an ads-free experience at Facebook. All these sort of ideas that people have about what big companies should or shouldn't do, these are like testable hypotheses. And that's really what the platform is for. 31% of people who use free dating apps are extremely interested in Facebook's new dating feature.
None of this is like actual 100% because you haven't really tested it, but for sure. This is like really valuable to give you an idea if you're like completely off the mark or you actually have a shot.
There's two things there. The first is that it's far more reliable than a survey because in a survey, people, you know, they tend to say yes to everything or they tend to not really have any skin in the game. Like they can't really visualize what you ask them. So if you say, would you use Facebook's new dating feature? What that means to one person may mean something completely different to someone else. This is all in the context of an actual experience they went through. They experienced something as they would in real life and are giving feedback to that. So it's much more authentic. The second piece is no, of course not. It's not an actual product. They didn't actually sign up for it and put their information into it, but it is comparative. So in all the tests, we try to recommend for our users as well, in the test, it should always be an A versus a B, right? It's not just, does someone want something for free? It's which of these two things do they want more? So at least you have something comparative.
Yeah, that's a good point. Survey is subjective when you hear the question.
Yes.
And then you can really like make the questions to get the answer that you want. You started by talking about the concept of lean and the critical place customer feedback has in that process. It is not quick. Even though you could be in a startup, it still can take a good amount of time. What is the main reason that lean has not been like really fast on getting customer use back feedback so far?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons. There's internal reasons and external reasons. Internally, at a big company, no one's paid to do it. It's quite frankly like their incentive structures in place, and if the incentives are to hit deadlines and to ship products that get budgeted, then you don't really have any incentive to ship the right product or to be responsible for the results afterward. I mean, someone is holding the bag ultimately at the end, but that's not the 99% of people that are involved in building the product. So it's just as simple as that. The second piece is that it's really difficult. I think it's very risky anytime startups kind of perfect some methodology and then just say, oh, big companies are stupid. They should do the same thing, right? Because that's not the reality. Big companies have very, very successful businesses for a reason. And after they've built a successful business, they build processes to ensure that that successful business, nothing happens to it, right? And those directly contradict lean. But also externally, if you're in a healthcare company, you have regulations that prevent you from just going and talking to your members and to your patients, right? If you're in a B2B company, the sales team manages those relationships. The product team doesn't. And it's not so straightforward to go and test things on those customers. A really common problem I see is, what if you test a feature with a big customer and they love it, but all your other customers don't like it? And then you have to now explain to this big customer that you have that you're not going to build it because other customers don't like it, when you've already exposed something that they think would solve their problems. So there's a lot of things that I don't think get factored into that conversation when startups say, oh, lean is great, we should, everyone should do lean. For a big company, there are a lot of risks in doing those iterations. And then, of course, they're just big organizations, so doing anything can take a long time if they're trying to do things manually. Anytime multiple stakeholders are involved, it just gets exponentially harder, more difficult, takes longer, throwing things over the fence. Not everyone knows each other. Communication has silos. So all those sort of things accumulate to mean that it just doesn't get done. They just don't iterate.
Lean, when it gets to the enterprise, is not necessarily fast. What about pricing? How do you charge customers? Is it like software as a service or per question? Mm-hmm. Or
yeah, it's software as a service. We understand there's a lot of experimentation tools out there that are pay as you go. And I think those are great. Again, if you're a startup that already buys into Lean and that's how you built your business from scratch through continuous iteration, that makes sense. Like, you know that you need those tools and you need to do that. For the larger organizations and in the industries that are really being disrupted, there's a huge amount of behavior change that has to happen there. So we want to find those companies that want to partner on that behavior change, on embracing an agile and iterative and lean culture and all these sort of good things we talk about, but really baking that into their workflows. So our platform is really the all-you-can-eat model. Test as much as you want. And that's how we sell it. So it's annual subscriptions to that. It scales based on the number of teams and the number of teams and workspaces that you have. And we partner with you on running as many experiments as you want. Because once you buy in, you get as much data as you want. So we want you to make use of it.
From a startup point of view, I mean, this sounds pretty useful, especially because you just don't have time to do a lot of these things. So it would be awesome to send a question and get this data in 2 days later. But so really it becomes a cost issue, right? I mean, the cost of the service is not...
It's also an unpredictability issue. If you have to ship a product in 3 months, but you start getting data that says you're shipping the wrong product, at a startup, you can change. You can say, okay, we're not going to ship that. At a large company, if you don't change your mindset and the way your company operates, it's not just the cost. It's, do we really want data telling us that we should change our deadlines and change the way we work? Like, you have to buy into that.
That was actually another question I had. Do you also help manage how the results are actually used inside the corporation, inside the enterprise, to make a decision?
Yeah, I mean, we're not consultants. We're not there to do strategy for our customers and our clients, but we are there to share best practices. And so you mentioned, we have the podcast before that's called This Is Product Management, 2 million downloads in the last few years. And so that, along with a bunch of other initiatives we have, are all part of that broader vision of helping large companies operate more like Amazon, right? And being experiment driven, high velocity decision making. So that's our business and we want to help them with that. But we wouldn't necessarily contextualize it to their specific business, their specific industry. We don't have that context. And that's we're not a team of MBAs. That's not what we do. We're there to help them learn best practices around data-driven decision-making.
Is Alpha used mostly for software projects, products, or is it for other products as well?
I would say mostly, but I've seen it used in marketing circumstances like conversion rates, even ad testing. Some interesting one is anytime that you need to get feedback from an audience that you're very disconnected to, we've had executives use it to test different presentations they were going to give at different conferences, right? So an executive who wants to go speak at an IT conference, want to get some quick insight into how IT people, perceive a certain challenge or perceive a headline for a talk, so it could mock up a conference and say, which of these talks would you be most interested in hearing? Right. So anytime you're disconnected from an audience is when you might use Alpha. There might be, better fits and less good fits depending on what you want to test.
But typically not like physical products, like say somebody's creating a new toy or.
It would be the e-commerce page. You would test like the checkout process or you would check. Right. You would test the software touch points with it, so the web touch points, but we wouldn't test the actual physical product.
The next question, it's the evolution of software product management or digital product management. Product management has been around for a long time, but there's something different about software and digital product management, and it's becoming almost its own industry. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we're at a really interesting time. Software has enabled workflows to change in the sense that, if you build a factory, if you realize you put it in the wrong place, it's kind of too bad. But you know, software, you can change it every day based on feedback. And now, of course, if you're in a heavily regulated environment, you have to go through compliance every time you make a change. It tends to be more like a factory than it is a software product. But I think what we've seen with software, generally speaking, is that you can iterate quickly. And then once you see all the benefits of iterating quickly, you start thinking, where else can we really iterate quickly? Like, where else are we treating things as if they're set in stone when they're really not? And I think marketing has gotten a lot more iterative in the past few years as well. And we're seeing that, you know, go into other fields where experiments, you know, sales teams are running experiments. Even physical products, they're seeing that there are ways to run experiments, even on slower iterations. So I think that's really the trend we're seeing. Not necessarily software product management maybe being a pioneer in that sort of iterative experiment-driven mindset, but I think we're going to see a lot of companies take advantage of that in other ways and other disciplines as well.
If you want to become a product manager in an e-commerce company, you really need to have some very specific skill sets and experience and knowledge of how e-commerce works. That's where I think the specific differences starting to become even more evident.
I see it both ways. I think you need a mix. You know, it definitely depends on your company. I think domain expertise is definitely helpful and you need a lot of that, but with every industry changing so quickly, it can be sometimes helpful to have people that are just good at experimentation that don't necessarily know your space and can come in and think a little bit differently about things and maybe question some of the assumptions. I think a healthy mix of those two is a good recipe for a lot of companies.
I agree. And also a healthy mix of experience versus just education.
Really
helps out. So how do you take this, the concept and what you believe in, what you've been practicing, into like hiring product managers? What are the key things that you're interested to find out? Let's say if you're hiring PMs for Alpha.
You
are hiring, right?
Yes. We are hiring. We're hiring across the board. In product specifically, we're hiring a director of product. I would say for everyone we hire, you know, the world is chaotic, and it's only accelerating. Like, I think Jeff Bezos had this really great quote in his latest letter to shareholders about, how customers are divinely discontent and what they want is constantly changing. And if you view it as just, there's a bar that you have to get to and then you're done, you've kind of missed the point in that every time you push the envelope, consumers expect something more, right? And so that's only going to accelerate, and that's really chaotic. So what we look for in everyone is someone who can feel comfortable in the chaos, does not need to necessarily – I don't want to frame it as necessarily lie to themselves, but people who don't want the false illusion of sense and order but realize that the world is chaotic and we're all trying to figure out how to operate in it. So I think that's particularly true of product managers. People who never feel like they have it figured out, but love that sort of chase, love that sort of chasing that divine discontent that consumers have. I think that's what you have to look for in product. Now, how do you test for that? I think you have to look at a variety of different approaches, but, you know, asking people when they, you know, what were some of the hardest challenges they had to face? How do they align different teams in the right direction? I think when someone comes in and they're just very confident about how they did things and they felt like it was done, they shipped it, it was a celebration, I think that's the wrong mindset. I think a continuous improvement mindset is what you have to look for. And that's every role, but particularly product.
Right. Now, I think the focus that you have on experimentation is really like one of the key things for me is when you're running an experiment, you have no idea what the results are.
Exactly.
You might have some, you know, preconceived, like, you know, intuition, but really you don't know, and you have to be open to both sides.
Yes, you have to fall in love with that process.
Yeah,
right. You have to be outcome driven in the sense that, you know, you want to do the right thing for the customer, and you want to, obviously that has to translate into business outcomes, but you have to fall in love with that learning process. And I think for the most part you can tell quickly if someone loves to learn or if they love to be right.
Okay, so I'm gonna like try to squeeze a little bit in here. What would be like a question that would tell you that about somebody?
Yeah, I mean, simple things of like, you know, giving a problem that your company is currently facing and ask them how they would go about solving it. If they go to a creative answer, that gives you the sense that they think they're creative and they're gonna reflect on their experience to make suggestions and sound smart. Versus what I would normally look for is which stakeholders here do they want to talk to first? Which customers do they want to talk to first and why? How are they going to prioritize and balance all that different feedback? That's that sort of answer gets at someone being experiment driven versus someone being creative driven. Because creativity, I just feel is grossly overrated. It's great to have when you're trying to figure out what to experiment with and new ideas. And I don't want to underestimate creativity. It is important, but it's not the first piece. Like the first piece is learning, and then creativity becomes helpful.
Right. And I think that's the difference between, at least my idea of it is between the idea of a breakthrough innovation as
Yes.
opposed to, I don't want to say incremental because it might not give a full value, but it's very important, but like making an existing process better.
Right.
So
Exactly.
creativity really is used and needed for breakthrough changes because this is like something that you haven't even thought about. Nobody's
Yes.
thought about, but most products, most work for product managers is not breakthrough innovation. It's actually
Right.
incremental innovation of an idea. Like, you know, when you join a startup, yes, you would like to have some breakthrough innovation, but not every day, not every month.
Exactly, but 90% of content and 90% of the conversation around product management is around breakthrough innovation. It's about these grand, big ideas. But that is not what most people, what their companies need them to do. Their companies need them to improve something that exists.
Right. So it sounds like, and this is a question for me, it sounds like you almost need two different types of PMs. You need the day-to-day, you know, in the trenches PMs that actually make the product better, and then you need the breakthrough PMs, the breakthrough product PMs. Does that make sense?
It does, but I would bias toward finding the former exclusively. And if you can get some tinkerers, some people that you know have they're good at experimenting outside the box, but also maybe have a little bit of vision in for the company. When you're a small company, I think really like the founders, the CEO, they need to have the vision. If they don't have that, I don't think any PM will have a lot of success coming in and driving breakthrough innovation because they won't have that buy-in. At a larger company, yeah, I definitely think you need more of a mix. You need some people, but again, if they're passionate about breakthrough innovation, why are they necessarily going to go to a very large organization unless you know they see that organization has the unique resources, the unique position in the market to do it? They're going to want to you know reap those riches for themselves for the most part. So I don't know if you can really hire for that. I don't know how you would do that. I'm open to suggestions, but finding someone with breakthrough innovation sort of mindset is usually the founders.
Right. Or if you can get Johnny Ive on your team or something,
Right,
it would
exactly. That's
be
the issue.
helpful.
Right.
So,
So that's one in a million.
right, more like a billion, probably.
Right, and exactly. But most people who think they're John Ivy, they're very much not. And then you have a much bigger problem on your hands. But
Right.
if you can find someone who can be that sort of aspirational visionary, then empower them as much as possible. But
Right.
hiring for that, I'm sure some companies have figured it out. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know how you would test for that in an interview, especially in today's economy where the interview processes are accelerated. Finding talent is very hard to find. You don't have necessarily the time to really tease all that out.
That actually sounds like, you know, I know your product roadmap is full,
Yeah.
but so that sounds like a really interesting question your platform could probably answer. Throw
Yeah, that's a testable hypothesis.
the name of a person and ask, is this person a good fit?
That might be risky for other reasons.
You also mentioned Jeff Bezos, which I admire as a business leader. You've heard of Day One, right?
Yeah, of course, of
So when
course.
you think
Yeah.
of Day One, what comes to your mind? What does it mean to you?
I think it's the high velocity decision making in terms of reversible decisions. One of the big problems I see, especially with large organizations and especially with organizations in industries that have been around for a while, for example, retail, is thinking that treating every decision with the same amount of weight. They treat every decision like you can't reverse it, but that's not the case. So I think you need a really good framework of what decisions can we not get wrong and what decisions can we get wrong and fix quickly, as long as assuming you'll fix them quickly. And then for the decisions you can fix quickly, what's the holdup? Why are we not trying everything under the sun to solve problems for customers and generate more value? And that, I don't think companies necessarily have that conversation. I think a lot of that has to come from leadership of saying, hey, let's draw a line in the sand. What things are we okay with people getting wrong as long as they fix it quickly? And that's what the day one really, really means to me. And Amazon, I think certain things like hiring, they take forever. They have a really robust hiring process that can take a long time. So they believe that that's something that you can't get wrong. But for other decisions that are reversible, it's like, why? Sometimes it's not even worth testing. Just make a decision and learn.
And also, people start to get comfortable when they're at the top. That's usually when they start going down and the competition catches up with them. The question that I see people talking about is they think that being innovative and constantly pushing for getting better is directly related to having like a crazy stressful life in work that you never, yes. Like you're paranoid, which is not without precedent. You go and you go to Silicon Valley right now, there's a big discussion. I'm sure New York has its own, that work can be really stressful. The concept of work-life balance is in question all the time. So, but for me, day one is not that. Day one is where you actually balance a positive outlook to innovate, as opposed to fear.
That's interesting. I think for a company like Amazon, I love learning from them, but they have this baked into their DNA and they've had it since, you know, day one, no pun intended. So what's the challenge is how do you add it to a company's DNA? I think we're still in the experiment phase there. Very few companies have successfully added experimentation to their DNA. You have companies that seem to have always had it, like Intuit and Amazon and companies like that. But I don't know how many companies have reinvented themselves with being experiment driven. Because like you said, so many people become complacent. And like, how do you do that behavior change at scale? That's a challenge that we face as a company that we're working on. And I don't know how many success stories are out there quite yet, but I'm sure there will be in the next few years.
A lot of this is like really just human issues.
Human dynamic.
My next big question is that how is AI going to change product management? Think 10 years from now. You know, a lot of things that we do right now don't need a person's attention. If we just do it because the software is not good enough to do it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I think, well, from an AI perspective, there's multiple facets there, that there's products that will have AI built into them, and then there's workflows that will have AI to enhance workflows. I think ultimately, though, and this is kind of like a principle here at Alpha, is that the future is going to be won by companies that where people closest to the problem are providing solutions. And you're only going to have that if companies really democratize decision-making, right? If they allow people to make decisions, they give them that sort of framework we talked about before of, you know, what's a reversible decision? How can you make a decision? If everything is top down, it doesn't really matter if you have AI or anything else. One group of executives in an ivory tower cannot keep up with how fast the market will change. So that's really where I see AI. So maybe AI helps people make decisions. That's the way we look at it with our platform at Alpha, is thinking, how can we entrust people to make decisions and help them make better decisions? And can that convince their companies to change the way they empower people? That's the way we look at it. But products having AI, I think, is really interesting as well. But again, you won't build the right product if a small group of people very, very far away are making all the decisions.
Right. And I think that's the concept of Ray Dalio talking about idea meritocracy.
Yes.
Is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think AI can give leaders the confidence that their employees are making the right decisions. If, you know, AI is doing checks, removing bias, things like that. I think what Bridgewater is doing around that could be really interesting in the coming years. But again, that's a one in a million company. So how do you bring that to any company? That's the problem we want to solve.
Right. Well, I think you're at a really interesting position to bring something like this into the enterprise. And the enterprise is the holy grail. It is so difficult to get innovation into the DNA. But so that's why it is a worthy cause.
Yeah, we hope so. It's one thing, and you mentioned before, it's a human thing. And one of the important things is to recognize that a company is not a monolithic group, right? It's individuals. Teams within one company operate drastically differently. Individuals on teams operate drastically differently. You have to humanize it. And that's what we do. We find the teams that believe in this new way of work, and we start there and we partner with them. There may be teams that don't get it at all, but you know, they will over time. And so you have to treat it that way. To think of an entire company as this whole company operates one way is inaccurate and doesn't help drive that behavior change. But focusing on individuals and teams is I think how to do it.
Exactly. And you know, this is completely another topic, but I think one way that actually enterprises can become more innovative inside is the actual technology that they use and the architecture of the teams and the concept of microservices.
Yes.
Which is really what enables you. I mean, you can talk about being innovative and agile and everything all day, but if your technology takes 3 months to do an update, you just have no, forget about it. So
yes, of course.
So I want to close by talking about your expertise in content and podcasting. I mean, you've got a pretty successful
sure.
podcast, and so that tells me that you really get the new content paradigm. And I want to learn some more about your thoughts on that and how things are working out, what you're learning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So we view content the exact same way we view product. We want to solve the market's problems. And some problems require technology, like what you just mentioned, and some problems can be solved with content, resources, education, right? So we're in the market of helping organizations become experiment-driven, helping any organization operate like Amazon. Some of that is education. Some of that is case studies. Some of that is a weekly podcast that introduces them to different topics from different leaders. And some of that is technology and capability. So we view it as the same. And our roadmap is problems to solve, themes around problems. And we look at what's the best way to solve it. Is it a podcast interview? Is it a new feature? Is it an article? Is it a video? And it might be, and this is typically what it is, for executives, it's videos, and for product managers, it's a podcast, and for analysts, it's, you know, white papers. And that's the way we look at it.
Very interesting. Not every medium works for every role.
Exactly.
So why do executives not listen to podcasts as much?
I don't know if they don't listen to podcasts. We found that video resonates really well with executives. I think naturally we can tell a story much faster in a video. So I think there's a time constraint. In a podcast, you can't necessarily skip around easily and see when it gets to a certain point. And also it takes a little longer because, you know, you have to explain things without the audience having a visual. In videos, we can combine animation and illustration into an interview, and you can convey a point very, very quickly. So when I say videos, like all those videos are less than 5 minutes, whereas a podcast of less than 5 minutes would not be very interesting.
That's an interesting point. How long of a podcast do you need to convey the same message that you can do in a 1 minute video or a 5 minute video?
Yeah,
not the same length.
No, not at all. That's why we've seen, you know, we've run a lot of tests. So for every channel you see, we have a podcast channel. We have a Medium publication, a video series, a few others. For everyone you see, there's 10 you don't see because we've tried 10 that didn't work out. So I think we've tried 25 to 50 channels at this point and different sort of content offerings. And we have about 4 or 5 that have been really successful. So we've learned so much in that process. But the key that I don't want people to forget is that we treat it the same way as product development, in that we experimented. We didn't just determine the podcast would be popular. The podcast was one of a bunch of initiatives we've tried throughout the years, and it worked. And we understand why it worked when we look at what else didn't work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was not as thorough and educated when I made the decision to start my own podcast, but I just knew that it worked for me. Because
yes.
It only requires one of my senses. I can drive and listen. I can run and listen. And video, rarely I can actually sit down and give my complete attention. I know it's a problem with me. It's probably the life or whatever. But for me, podcasts, and that's why podcasting is becoming actually like really popular now.
That's funny. And I'll tell you a little secret. I have a very difficult time listening to podcasts. I just can't learn that way. I don't. for whatever, it just doesn't resonate, I have a much easier time with video.
It's a learning style as well. I'm also a visual learner. I have to see and hear. This is very exciting. I'm really happy to hear about what Alpha is doing. Look forward to see how things develop.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for taking the time. I really enjoyed this conversation. Hope your listeners do as well.
Yes. Thank you so much, Nis.